doing today. Do any of you have any questions, especially from last week? Last week we talked about a walking meditation. Yeah.
What do we do with our hands?
During walking meditation? Anything that you want. Something restful, usually. I often put them in my pockets. Or sometimes hook them over my belt. Or some people have them behind their backs, or sometimes in front like this. Yes?
Is this the second in the series?
No, this is in between the series.
So how many Thursday sessions since you started?
I don't know, but it seems to me like the series ended about 3 or 4 weeks ago. See, about 3 or 4 times a year I do an introductory course for 5 weeks.
When does the next one start?
Well, it's not until the end of September or the beginning of October. Maybe the first Thursday in October. So it's actually quite a ways away. So in terms of getting, you know, the basic instructions, this is not, you know, the place. Though I try, at the beginning of the sitting, it became at 7. I give very kind of rudimentary instructions to get people kind of started. And then the discussion hopefully supports a beginner sitting, but you're not going to get all the basics all at once the coming on Thursdays until the next course.
So did you sit from 7 to 7:30?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I thought it started at 7:30.
Yeah. It's easy to make a mistake because it's Mondays we start at 7:30.
Yeah, Monday, yeah. So we won't be sitting again until 8:15?
It's a long time away. I'm sorry, yeah, that's right. The way you said it seems so.
Yeah,
well.
You're going to jog for a while.
You can go for a walk and come back, or you can hang out. Yes?
I have. Since this isn't the 5 week course,
no?
How is it different than that? And is this Thursday now, since it's not a beginning course, is it the same as like a Monday?
No, it's more oriented towards beginners.
Still?
Yeah.
Even though it's not 5 weeks?
Even though it's not 5 weeks, it's more oriented towards beginners. And
how is it different from that 5 week course, right? Like right now what we're doing tonight, how would this be different?
The 5 week course, I give kind of systematic instructions on the basic practice, and kind of each week I kind of build on the week before. And we don't start with a sitting, but rather we start with giving instructions. And I talk a little bit about the things related to the instructions that kind of support the practice. And today, which is more, it's mostly just, well, you'll see what it is today. It'll be kind of a beginning. What I had in mind today was to talk about the eating meditation. For those of you who are new, mindfulness practice, people think that, you know, we're teaching a meditation practice here. And it is a meditation practice. It's a very powerful meditation practice. What we're really interested in is mindfulness. And mindfulness is something we bring to all our life, to all our activities. And so we talk about different activities we bring mindfulness to, awareness. And last week I talked about walking meditation, which is also a formal meditation that we do. And today what I thought of talking about was eating meditation, because it just seemed like a good kind of more beginner topic. And eating meditation, eating kind of is kind of a microcosm of our rest of our life. So it's a wonderful place to discover our life, to wake up and pay attention to. It's a great avenue into our depths of our life. And also I thought of doing it because I don't talk about eating meditation during the 5 week introductory course. And I've never really talked about it a lot. And I'm supposed to as a Vipassana teacher. It's kind of like in the job description. And I'm supposed to pass out 8 raisins. And there's a raisin exercise with you all. And I've resisted for all these years, but I brought raisins today. So that's what I had in mind. Yes?
You mentioned during the last introductory course, we were talking about asking about ethics.
Uh-huh.
So usually, like, they would be taught, you never learn how to do Vipassana without any ethics.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if in this in-between period, whether we might approach more teachings on
I think that would be great. And maybe next week I can talk about ethics some. Because the ethics, or the word for ethics in Pali, in Buddhism, is sila. And sila literally means a foundation. And it lays a foundation upon which it becomes possible to pay attention, to pay careful attention to your life. The idea being that if you're leading an unethical life, it's very hard to pay attention. If you just robbed the bank, you're not going to be thinking about paying attention, or very different kind of quality of attention, at least. So it's a very important thing to talk about. And so I'll think about a little bit how it can be done. What will happen is the month of July, those four Thursdays in July, I don't teach in July. It's my one month a year not to teach. And but there's going to be a series of other people coming take my place. And one possibility is to ask each of them to take one of the precepts each of those weeks. There's five precepts, so you do four of them. And discuss it and have it. And that could be, they might enjoy having a topic like that. And would it interest enough of you to do that? It's very different from 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And if you'd asked 25 years ago if people were interested in meditation, if you wanted to spend a month talking about ethics, they all would have left. Because, you know, what does ethics have to do with meditation or spirituality? And, you know, 30 years ago, people got interested in spirituality, at least a lot of the young people, because they wanted to get away from somehow the constraining and hypocritical ethical systems they saw around them. And so they had an aversion to it. And slowly over the years, we've learned in Buddhist circles that we need to talk about ethics also, and ethics are a really important part of the practice, and a joyful part of the practice, not something that limits us, but really opens our life in a very deep way. So it's nice to hear that people are interested in it. It's for a change. So I was going to, I want to talk, I have these raisins. I have to do something with. I thought of reading first this Zen story, a Zen koan, as an introduction to the topic. And the story goes, once a monk made a request of the abbot Joshu. I have just entered the monastery, he said. Please give me instructions, master. Joshu said, have you had your breakfast? Yes, I have, replied the monk. Then said Joshu, wash your bowls. And the monk had insight. The monk had an understanding. So I think, for me, it's a beautiful story. It's very simple. But all these stories, they're in these kind of collections because they're for us to reflect on and see what we can pull out of them and see what is beneath the surface. And the monk has just arrived. You can imagine a young monk or a young nun or something has come to a monastery and just gung-ho for enlightenment or gung-ho for doing spiritual practice. And they want to get the real teaching. You know, give me instructions. How do I get about getting enlightened? What's the point? How do I do it? And lots of people come, you know, especially young people who are kind of idealistic, come with this, you know, great zeal to get some kind of wonderful spiritual awakening or whatever. So they ask for instructions. And so the master didn't answer him. Kind of avoided the subject, seemingly. He said, well, have you had your breakfast? And the monk said, yeah, I had my breakfast. What's the, you know? And then he said, well, then please go wash your bowls. And in saying those things, he was giving instruction, the kind of very instruction the guy was asking for. Because spiritual life is not separate from the small details of our daily life, but it includes our daily life. If we think that spirituality or think of Buddhist practice or mindfulness is something that's kind of esoteric or transcendental to our normal everyday life, we'll miss it entirely. So he asked him such a simple question, have you had your breakfast? Because if you haven't had your breakfast, what you should do is go have breakfast. And eating breakfast becomes your spiritual practice. Eating your breakfast becomes your discipline, your mindfulness practice. And then he had had his breakfast. So then have you washed up? Have you washed the dishes? No, I'm leaving that for tonight when I get home from work, or, you know, or tomorrow or the weekend. Go wash your dishes. That also is your spiritual life. And just What we tend to do is compartmentalize our life so much anyway in our society. But one of the compartmentalizations we do is between a spiritual life, an awakened life, a mindfulness life, and the rest of our life, a mundane kind of plebeian life or whatever. And that split is what we're trying to heal, at least in Buddhism, so that we don't see a difference between our spiritual life and the rest of our life, our daily life. And so things like eating and washing your dishes become activities that we engage ourselves in with mindfulness, with awareness. And what becomes very interesting for a student of mindfulness is to pay attention to what makes it difficult for you to stay present in a very simple way for these simple daily activities. We tend to be so much in a rush, or we tend to so much avoiding ourselves because it's painful to be in ourselves, or we have all these agendas we want to do. That's a lot of the simple daily activities of our life we're lost for. We kind of rush through them, we toss the dishes in the washing machine, we close, we rush through them kind of ahead of ourselves. And because we want to get somewhere. And where do we want to get? What really holds value for us in our lives? What are our primary priorities? And for a lot of people, the primary priorities of their life sometimes are not their daily life. It's something other than. They want to kind of get things done so they can go out and go, I don't know what people do. But it's all, it's often something else. And it's not that it's wrong to do all kinds of wonderful things. But do we do that at the expense of not being really present for our daily life, for such simple things as... So earlier today I met with this woman who described her life to me. She doesn't do a lot. Her life is relatively simple. She works and she has to commute a lot between work and home. And she plays a musical instrument, and which requires a lot of practice. And so she comes home and relaxes for just a couple of minutes, and then eats dinner, and then practices for a few hours, and then is tired, and then goes to sleep. And she feels she really wants to meditate and have a meditation practice, but she has a hard time finding time for it in the schedule she set up for herself. And but it turns out she drives at least 45 minutes each way to work and back. And so what I talked with her about was how to make driving a meditation. And because when she's driving, she tends to, that's a time when her anxiety level goes up. And you can imagine it's easy, especially if you have to go across to 880 and up. Your anxiety level goes up, and the anxiety level, she starts planning and worrying about all the things she might forget or needs to take care of. And so she has this notepad, and she writes things down on the notepad. And then she tears them up. When she gets to her office, she kind of takes her little notes and makes up a list of things to do. But she's kind of ahead of herself, planning and rushing and not really present for her breath and for the simplicity of driving, for whatever. And since she drives so much, what I talked to her about was making driving her meditation practice. And find some value and satisfaction in the simple thing of driving. Because if we're in a spiritual life, you can find your deepest satisfaction in everything, anything that you do. It isn't something different where you're going to find your spiritual life. You can find it in whatever you're doing. And it's worth doing that. I didn't tell her to find it in all the different details of her life, but choose this one thing that she does a lot of. It's very repetitive. And find it there. And it's very easy to feel, well, that's not important. Spiritual life is not important. Being present, being awake, being mindful is not important. It's more important to plan the day. It's more important to... she talked about rushing home and throwing open the door and rushing to her telephone and listening to all the messages, kind of in a frantic, and writing them down, and then rushing to, at the same time going to the kitchen and starting to make dinner and doing all this stuff to kind of get her stuff going, get her life kind of going to get somewhere. And why not be where you're at in a wholehearted and wonderful, joyful way? And it's possible. So we do it also with eating. Eating is a wonderful place to practice eating meditation, to practice mindfulness. And in formal retreats, we go on one-day retreats or longer retreats. The retreats are in silence, and so all the meals are in silence. And people will eat the meals in silence. And for many people, it's often the first time in a long time that they've eaten really in silence, really sitting there with the food. Because if we're eating at home and we're alone, well, we bring out the newspaper, we turn on the television or the radio, or the newspaper and the television. You know? And because we don't want, you know, we want to use that time efficiently, effectively, and get, you know, if you can read the newspaper while you're eating, then you can go off and, right? And in some sense, it's more efficient, but it's inefficient for spirituality, because spirituality is about really being present in a deep, satisfying way with what you're doing. And of course, you can put it off. You're welcome to put it off. But why not do it while you're doing it? Do it now. Anyway, eating is a wonderful place to cultivate mindfulness. And people who go in retreats, for some people, it's one of the most happiest part of the retreats, is finding this enjoyment and being present for their food without any distractions, just you and the food. There's a story, another Zen story, about this monk who is being chased by a tiger. And he comes to the edge of a cliff, and the tiger's behind him, so he goes over the cliff because it seems safer than getting eaten by the tiger. And he goes over the cliff, and he kind of falls, and he hangs onto a branch that's sticking out, a thin little branch. And the tiger's above him, kind of growling, ready to eat him. And he looks down, and below him is another tiger waiting for him to fall. And then he notices the branch is beginning to break. And then he notices that in front of him, in the cliff, face of the cliff, is a strawberry plant. And so he reaches out with his other hand and picks a strawberry. And, sweet, as the branch breaks. So that's really being in the present moment. And I think it's a beautiful story because, I mean, I guess the idea of the story is that it's hopeless. You know, there's no way out. You can't go up or down or anything, right? So in that situation, why don't you, the least you can do is eat the strawberry. You can always, you know, cry for help, but what good does it do? Just eat the strawberry. So eating meditation, eating. I think some people have said that eating is America's most favorite compulsive activity. And that if you really understand eating and the compulsion around eating, it's kind of like the granddaddy or grandmother or whatever of all addictions. And if you understand eating and pay attention to what goes on when you eat, you're a long way to understanding all the other kind of addictions and hungers we have. Hungers for, what are some of the hungers we have in our life? Give me some examples. We hunger for
alcohol.
Alcohol. Okay, what else?
Greed,
pleasure, excitement. What? Boy, you people, this struck a chord here. What else?
Adventure.
Hunger for adventure.
Safety.
Hunger for safety.
Fame.
Hmm?
Fame.
Thing?
Fame.
Oh, fame.
Sex.
Sex. It's one of the great ones.
Success.
Success.
Courage.
I suppose love. Hunger for love. In Buddhist vocabulary, the word for that's sometimes translated as desire, but it's not appropriate to translate as desire. The word that we should be translated as craving, and craving is a source of suffering in Buddhist psychology. The word, literal word, means thirst. And maybe in our English vocabulary, we could say hunger. So the desire for love or courage could be come from a very wholesome place. But the hunger for it comes from some place that, some feeling of lack or suffering or inadequacy. And it kind of, hunger is often an attempt to fill, often inappropriately, fill some sense, fill something that wasn't nurtured properly, something that's not paying attention to properly. In Buddhist cosmology, there are five different realms, depending on the system, five or six, but five different realms of beings. And people get reborn in different realms of beings. And one of the realms is the human realm, which all of us have been reborn in. And it's considered to be very auspicious to be reborn as a human. It's one of the most fortunate rebirth you can have, or there is the most fortunate rebirth you can have, because it's only in the human realm that you're really going to engage yourself in a spiritual practice and wake up. A more pleasurable rebirth is to be born in the heavens as a god. And there's many gods in Buddhism. There's a pantheon of gods that live up in the heavens. And you can get reborn there. Some of you have probably been gods, according to Buddhist cosmology. And many, many lifetimes of we've kind of been cycling through. And it's pretty wonderful to be reborn as a god, because the Indian gods are, you know, the Greek gods were kind of always angry and kind of fighting with each other. Well, the Indian gods are all kind of, all it is pleasure. And you find an entourage of the most beautiful people of the opposite sex, and all the food you want, and all the wonderful music you possible, and just everything just really wonderful in these celestial heavens that the Buddhists have come up with, invented. But when you have too much pleasure and too much delight, you're not going to be very inspired to do any kind of spiritual practice, to wake up, because what's the point? You're having a good time. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's not so good to get reborn as a god. So those are two. The third one is as animals. Animal life is not considered to be so good, but it's not so bad either, but depending on the kind of animal, I guess. But anyway, it's a lower rebirth than human realm. And then I'll skip the fourth one for now. And the fifth one, which is the lowest realm, is the hell realms. And hell realms are, you know, just awful places, and you burn for a long time, and you get frozen in ice for a long time, and you know, you get boiled in hot water for a long time, and whatever people, you know, people's imaginations, right? They kind of, you can, like Dante and Inferno. But the only nice thing kind of about the Buddhist hells, as opposed to other hells of other religions, is in Buddhism it's temporary. Everything's temporary in Buddhism. So, you know, you do your time. And now the last one, the last of these realms, is called the realm of the hungry ghosts, and that's what I wanted to mention today. The hungry ghost realm is the realm of where people, beings, have very, very small mouths, and even smaller, kind of pencil thin, or even smaller, kind of floss thin throats. But then they have huge, huge distended bellies that are empty and hungry. And they just simply can't get enough food in through that mouth fast enough to satisfy this huge empty stomach. And it's kind of one of the uncomfortable places to get reborn. One of the ways of interpreting these five different realms of rebirth is that they're not about different lifetimes, but rather each of us get reborn in these five realms throughout each day. And there are times when we're in heavenly realms, and times when we're in hell realms, and we also find ourselves in hungry ghost realm. And Asian teachers who come to America and look around the American culture are amazed at what they find. And they say, oh, America is the realm of hungry ghosts. It's a realm where people have these huge appetites, these huge hungers that can never get satisfied, because what we're trying to satisfy, we're trying to satisfy the wrong thing. So it's interesting to pay attention to how we eat. Simply to pay attention to how we eat. Again, from a Buddhist point of view, I said something about this last week. It's not important. The what of our life, the what we're doing, isn't as important for us as the how we do it. We don't want to be too dogmatic about this distinction, but the how is more important than the what. And the how we eat is arguably more important than what we eat. And Buddhists traditionally have not been very keen on setting up the diet you're supposed to have, or the right diet. There is some tendency in East Asian Buddhism, in China and Korea, for Buddhists, especially Buddhist monks and nuns, to be vegetarians. But in India and Southeast Asia, there's no diet you're supposed to eat. They don't talk about that, but how you eat becomes very important. And the how we eat often is a way of nourishing ourselves also. If you eat compulsively, regardless of what it is, even this most healthy food possible, if you eat compulsively, kind of stuffing it down and overeating, or and kind of doing all these 10 things at once while you're eating, you're missing out on a whole level of nourishment, which is possible if you eat mindfully and with presence. If you eat in a sense of really being aware of what you're eating, connecting with what you eat, feeling yourself, feeling being connected to your body, eating from the body instead of from your imagination or your mind or from your craving, eating from the heart rather than the mind. And what's very interesting, if you pay attention while you eat, if you're really present while you eat, you can feel that there is a kind of connection you have with your body as you eat, because you wouldn't eat, hopefully, unless you were hungry. And then you can follow the sensations in your body as you eat, and you can notice that there comes a point where if you eat one more bite, it starts to, if one bite too much, you'll begin severing or dampening or clouding over the intimacy or the awareness we have of our body or of our deeper inner sense of self. And if you keep eating beyond that limit, we become more and more damped down. Our awareness becomes more and more, we kind of numb ourselves. You have this experience? You know what I'm talking about? And so it becomes very interesting to pay attention to that dividing line. Can you be there for that dividing line and not go beyond that, so you can stay really alert and present? So to eat mindfully. And in some ways there's no technique behind it, you just do it. But it certainly helps to eat slowly. And it helps if you do one thing at a time. Just eat your food and don't do all kinds of other things at the same time. Just simply be there in a very simple way with your food. I don't do this every meal I eat by myself. I mean, I do sometimes read the newspaper or read something while I eat. But I try to make a practice to regularly, sometimes it means once a day, have a meal where I just sit with the food and just eat it. And just stand there with the food. And if I do that, it's kind of like a meditation period. At the end of that session of eating that food, not only have I eaten in a more satisfying way, and eaten more consciously and more appropriately, but being quiet with myself at that time, I feel more connected with myself, and I've nourished something else also. I've nourished my sense of intimacy with myself. What a lot of people lack is a sense of intimacy with themselves. And I like this expression we have, attention deficit disorder, is that what they're called? And I think it means you don't have enough attention, you can't concentrate enough to pay attention to what's going on around you long enough. But I think it goes the other direction also, that we suffer a deficit of not receiving enough attention from ourselves. We're simply not present enough for our experience and for ourselves. And if you're not present for yourself, I think we become sick. You see it in children very clearly. Children, if they don't get attention from their parents or from other people, it causes tremendous grief, a lot of suffering for the children if they don't get the right kind of attention growing up. And as adults, we don't get it from our parents anymore. We have to do it for ourselves. We have to be able to see ourselves in a very deep way. When I was in the monasteries, I spent, there was a lot of opportunities for eating. Actually, I spent, in the monasteries, that's all you do is eat in silence. I mean, not all you do. Well, you know, sometimes I think this is a secret that I've been to a lot of different Buddhist monasteries and meditation centers and centers around all over the world, and the conclusion I've come to is that secretly Buddhism is a food cult. Food is always so good and well prepared. I've never eaten so well as I have in all these different Buddhist centers. But In monasteries, you know, eating is almost always done in silence, and just you're eating, you're there with the food. So I spent years being intimate with my food, my eating, and especially more before, a person who eats very fast. If you eat with me, you'll see I still eat fast, but That's okay. That's who I am. But I eat fast mindfully. But I used to eat a lot faster, and it was so compulsive that one of the things I did was I switched hands. So I'm right-handed, so I would eat with my left hand, and it was a little bit awkward to do that, so I'd slow down, have more presence. And that's an interesting experiment to do, is just eat with the other hand as a way of bringing more mindfulness and presence to what you're doing, and less compulsion. The other thing is you can do is, which is very nice, this is to put your utensil, your fork or your spoon down, take a bite, put it down and release it, and then chew and swallow. And only when you're swallowed, then pick it up again. Because what happens, if you pay attention, you'll probably notice that you do this, many of us do, is we'll take a bite and then just begin chewing. And then before we bring up the other bite kind of ready to go. You know, and the poor bite's in there, feels rushed. So that's one possibility, is to put the utensil down, and that brings more presence. One of the rules for Buddhist nuns and monks is they're not allowed to eat anything standing up. And I think that's a great rule, especially for monks. Luckily we're not monks, but anyway, it's a great thing, because if you eat standing up, you're more likely to eat compulsively and unconsciously. But if you sit down, you're more likely to be present while you're eating. So I think that's one other kind of practice a person can do if you want to eat mindfully. Make a habit of always sitting down when you eat or drink. So there's paying attention to the actual experience of eating, tasting the food. My mother used to tell me growing up, because I ate so fast, she would say, "Enjoy your food," she said, as if I wasn't enjoying my food. And you can't enjoy your food if you're not conscious, not present. And so you can, part of mindfulness of eating is just simply being present to enjoy and really sense and experience what the food is like. And it's also to discern what our relationship is to eating. Because if you sit and you're mindful, you'll feel if there's that kind of hunger or compulsion to eat, or to eat more, or this desire for more pleasure, or for more, to fill yourself more. Or if you're eating out of a sense of loneliness, to fill the loneliness. Or you're eating out of a sense of, to fill a kind of feeling of inadequacy. Or if you're eating out of a sense of, you know, people eat when they're depressed, people eat when they're angry, people eat when they're, you know, all kinds of reasons, right? It isn't just simply because they're hungry. So if you pay attention, you can discern all the other reasons why we eat, or the other things we bring to eating. And if you pay attention to those other things, it's the paying attention to them that's the beginning of healing them. If they remain unconscious or subconscious or semi-conscious, there isn't going to be much healing or opening or deepening into those experiences. But if you feel you're eating out of loneliness, and then you bring your mindfulness to loneliness and really explore what loneliness is about, there's a possibility of a healing that. If we're afraid of our loneliness, or the loneliness makes us restless, or we try to escape it all the time, the loneliness will always be there. You just kind of cover it up by all these busy activities. And that's not a very healthy way to live, to have all these kind of tendencies covered. In Buddhism, the theory or tenet in Buddhism is that by really paying attention, really being honestly acknowledging what our tendencies are, that's the beginning of healing them, whatever form that healing might take. So it's a huge and wonderful world, the world of eating meditation. And I've known people, especially on retreats, who eating meditation has opened up their practice, their mindfulness themselves, in a phenomenal way. Like some of the deeper insights they had from this meditation practice didn't come from formally sitting in meditation posture. in sitting informal meditation practice, but came from eating very mindfully and carefully. And in terms of integrating mindfulness into daily life, it's an obvious place to begin bringing some more mindfulness into our daily life. So I did bring the raisins, which I thought maybe in my vocation as a mindfulness teacher, I thought I would never do it.
Why not?
Oh, why not? Because I'm not sure why not, but I think that when I practiced in Asia, they didn't have raisins, and it seemed kind of, and when I came to America and all the teachers were doing raisins, it felt a little bit, it felt kind of silly to me to pass out raisins, have people eat raisins mindfully, and I kind of didn't really, I felt it was enough just to talk about it. But maybe I've changed my mind, and I think a lot of people learn a lot better experientially, and so anyway, we'll try it. Maybe it'll be a disaster to pass out raisins, and it'll be no fun. But we can always try it. So why don't you take. Take about, you know, 5-6 raisins. And then just hold them. Everyone has raisins? Okay. And so you can try any of these steps at home. But first you can just sit and close your eyes. Just sit there for about, you don't have to change your posture, just close your eyes. And then feel how you feel right now. Then feel your breath for the next 3 or 4 cycles of breathing. Just allow yourself to stay with your breathing. And then open your eyes and then look at the raisins. See what it is you have there. Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese teacher, he talks about reflecting on all the things that had to happen beforehand in order for you to have your food in front of you. The people who had to grow it, the people who transported it, who processed it, the sun that had to be there, and the water, and the earth, and all these things, all the huge interconnected web that supports our life had to be there to in this raisin. And then also you can just now touch it and feel the raisins with your fingers, the texture, the stickiness, or the feelings. Many of us are taught we're not supposed to play with the food. But you can also feel it. Feel it. Discovering, like you've never had a raisin before, kind of first time feeling it. Its bumps and ridges. And then pick up in your hands two or three of the raisins. And then place it on your tongue in your mouth, but don't chew, just place it there. And kind of roll it around, feel the texture in your mouth. And then you can start just chew for a while without swallowing. Feeling, sensing the different flavors as they get released. And then continue to chew until maybe there's no more flavor. Feeling the pleasurable sensations and the bland sensations. And then feeling maybe the intention, the motivation to swallow. And then mindfully swallowing. And then sensing what it feels like in your mouth now. And then you can do the same thing with the rest of the raisins you have.